Dear Lonely Piperters, before starting this episode, we wanted to share with you some information about its specifics. Last summer, we were honored to have Magdalena Skipper, editor-in-chief of Nature, to share tips with the community. When Nature announced its new open access policy last November, we asked her to come back in January 2021 to give her a platform to be heard on these specific issues. This is why this episode is built in two parts, with first a classic interview and then an extended discussion on this announcement. As a result, this episode is longer, but it includes enriched content that we think you would like to hear. So get ready for this episode, and we hope you will enjoy it as much as we enjoyed recording it. Thank you, and let's get started!
Success has so many different faces, and it has to be defined by the person in question. Because in the end, if everybody else thinks you're successful but you're not happy with what you're doing, that is hardly success.
Are you working in research, trying to do the best science you can?
Are you a team leader, a research assistant, postdoc, PhD student, or any other type of scientist?
Are you looking for a place where you can sit, relax, and listen to inspiring people?
Well, we have good news for you. You've just found what you're looking for.
Hi everybody, my name is Renaud Pourpre.
And I am Jonathan Weitzman.
Welcome to the Lonely Pipette,
helping scientists
do better science.
My name is Magdalena Skipper. I'm the editor-in-chief of Nature and chief editorial advisor for Nature Research Portfolio. It's really fun to have this opportunity to share my tip with the Lonely Pipette today.
Thank you, Magdalena. Welcome to the Lonely Pipette. So Magdalena Skipper did her PhD at the MRC Lab of Molecular Biology, the University of Cambridge, working on C. elegans in Jonathan Hodgkin's lab. She was a postdoc in Julian Lewis's lab at what was then the ICRF and is now called Cancer Research UK. She then joined the Nature Publishing Group, where she's had many jobs working as chief editor of Nature Reviews in Genetics, senior editor for Genetics and Genomics at Nature, editor-in-chief of Nature Communications before becoming the editor of Nature. Magdalene is passionate about mentorship, innovation in science publishing, and research integrity. In 2018, she launched the Nature Research Inspiring Science Award for Early Career Female Researchers. She serves on the advisory board of the University of Oxford Centre for Personalised Medicine and the International Congress on Peer Review and Scientific Publications. And she's a member of the Scientific Advisory Council for the UK Blavatnik Awards for Young Scientists. Magdalena, thanks for coming to give tips to the Lonely Pipette.
It's my pleasure.
Thank you, Magdalena, to be with us today. It's a pleasure to have you here. You have a really interesting path in your career and a really interesting profile. And so we like to know the origin story of the people that we invite here. And so tell us how you decided to become a scientist.
Do you know, I'm not sure that I ever made a conscious decision to become a scientist, but certainly my interest in science, and actually specifically in biology, goes back to very, very early days in my life. It was just a topic that I naturally gravitated to. I was interested in the world around me, but mainly the organic part of that world and the alive part of that world. And it was, you know, this inquisitiveness that I think we all have as children. If you think about it back to your own childhood, or if you have your own kids now, they continuously ask questions. And there's always this question, but why, but why, but why? And of course, I was no different. Everybody goes through that phase. But I guess those of us who choose a scientific career never really lose that appetite for knowledge and understanding why. And understanding how something works. And so very early, as I was, when I was a child, when I was still at school, and certainly did not think in terms of becoming a scientist or going down the science career, I began sort of little, completely uncontrolled experiments, but just trying to probe, how things worked and so on. And so then as I went through school, it really became clear that I wanted to learn more and more about biology and the basis of life. And at some point in high school, I think it was early high school, that at school we had extended program of genetics, so really learning about inheritance, genetic basis to traits. And this was really the aspect of biology that fascinated me the most. And so from that point, I knew that that was something I wanted to pursue further.
Great. So you kept your child soul to jump into this. What would you have done if you didn't become a scientist?
Now that's an impossible question to answer. Well, when I was little, again, often as so many of us, we have different dreams and aspirations, and we imagine what our life might be at some point in the future. And, at some point, I wanted to be a firefighter. At some point, I wanted to be a superhero. please don't try and psychoanalyze me because I just said that. And at some point, I wanted to be a ballet dancer or a gymnast. And, that was something I really loved when I was very young. And part of me, at my current age, wishes that I kept up that particular fascination because life would have been different and perhaps easier. It really is impossible to say, but perhaps another passion which I had, and I have continued in some way until now, is a passion for languages. I'm really fascinated by how languages and cultures are linked and how they interact and how in different cultures and in different languages, we as humans express ourselves in slightly different ways, although the fundamentals of what we communicate are really common. And so perhaps I would have been a linguist. I don't know. Who knows?
So as you said, it's hard to predict where life will take you. But when you started, you did a PhD in Cambridge, and then you took the classic decision to do a postdoc. At the time, did you think you were going to have a normal scientific career, like a postdoc, second postdoc, group leader?
Yes. And so very interestingly, at the time, I actually thought exactly what you said, a normal scientific career. And very importantly, I don't think this is a normal scientific career anymore. And of course, different things look differently from a different perspective. So yes, and I actually remember this very, very clearly. When I started my PhD in Cambridge, I was super excited. It was just this, amazing, it was an amazing place to be doing a PhD, incredible intellectual environment with all these learning opportunities. I was very excited about my project. I studied sex determination. I felt that conceptually that was such an interesting topic to study. One of those aspects of biology, which of course evolves very fast, so you can look at different mechanisms, different outcomes. At some point in this very, I think, very sweet sort of a young person's naivety, right in my first year of my PhD, I had a whole career planned out for the rest of my scientific life. I was going to do this comparative evolution studies of sex determination and so on. So yes, I did. That was the only thing that I was focused on. I think, academic career, doing a postdocs, and then running a lab was what I imagined myself doing. I certainly never imagined myself being an editor.
So what happened? What prompted the career transition? Even though I'm happy to call it normal, but what precipitated the change, the transition, and how did that come about?
Sure. So just to say one comment on the topic of normal. So of course the scientific career, which takes you from a PhD onto a postdoc onto a group leader, is a normal career. But then so are all the other careers that follow on from a PhD. So I think, in some cases, my career is called an alternative career. I'm not sure that there's so much, it's so alternative what I do. And also really the reality is, of course, the vast majority of PhD students don't go on to leading groups. So in terms of majority and, you know, the straightforward path, that of course is a bit of a different picture. But to come back to your question, it was a bit of an organic shift, actually. It wasn't a conscious decision along the lines of, you know, I can't take the lab anymore, I must do something else. Definitely not. And as I said already, I didn't plan. I didn't think, oh my God, this is this amazing career out there and I need to complete my PhD and a postdoc so that I can become an editor. No, that was not how it worked. I think it was really a very gradual realization that there are different ways in which I myself could contribute to the research community and progression of research. And of course, one way to do it is to do the discovery, the investigation itself. And that's what, of course, happens when you stay in the lab or in active research. But there are so many other ways in which you can contribute to this. And I felt that I could make a better contribution in a slightly different way. And the reality of it was, you know, I was coming to the end of my postdoc and I thought, I'm interested in so many things. And as we all know, at the beginning of your career, you have to focus. You have to focus on one or a very limited number of questions in order to make true contribution and true progress. Later on, it can be different. But I was at this stage when I had to focus and I felt that it was difficult for me. It was a difficult decision. I will be honest and say that I had other interests outside of my scientific focus. As we know, science is a very jealous profession, right? You need to spend the time. And literally, I came across an advert at the back of Nature for associate editor on Nature Reviews Genetics. It was a journal that at that point was 6 months old. They described what an editor did. I had never really considered this before. And I thought, this sounds quite interesting, actually. I might just apply and see what happens. And through, as a result of a very interesting interview process, actually, you know, I ended up being absolutely passionate about it. And in fact, I became so enthused about doing this job that clearly I was very convincing in the interview because they offered me the job. and the rest really is history.
So we want to talk to you a lot about the publishing process and then a little bit more about the future of publishing. But sort of just generally, so publishing is such a key part of being a scientist and navigating academia. What do you think are the key points that researchers should keep in mind when they want to publish?
Very clearly, you have to think about the message that you want to convey. And what I mean by this is actually the meaning of the statement I just made has many different levels. So very clearly, the message has to be convincing. So you need to be convinced, you need to be sure that the message that you want to put out there is a message that you believe in because of the data you've collected, because of the analyses that you've done, and then you've robustly constructed a set of arguments. Another way of saying what I just said is that you have a story to tell. Researchers sometimes shy away from that expression because storytelling, certainly in English, has a certain connotation of maybe not being necessarily true.
In French, it's even worse.
Okay.
Yeah, raconter des histoires, it's okay. Worse. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
But this really is storytelling. Every single thing we do in communicating with one another involves storytelling. And science has so many compelling stories to tell. You know, our audience, be that an audience of professional researchers or an audience or a general public, will be compelled more by a story that is told better in a more accessible, better constructed way. So there are a number of things to consider. And this is around the presentation. You know, also, I suppose, in what I said is a hint for when you should feel ready to tell your story. In other words, indeed, when you are convinced that the arguments you will present are robust. Another consideration, of course, is who your audience is. Are you telling the story? Are you sharing your results? Are you publishing for a very technical audience, an audience who is already familiar with the field and maybe with your own work. So in other words, it's really going to be used and followed up by a relatively small but a core group that is advancing a relative or a specific topic. Or are you writing for a wider audience? Are you writing maybe for another discipline where you feel your findings or your technology, methodology, whatever it is that you work on, may be useful, or it could even be instrumental in pushing that other field further? Or indeed, whether you're writing for a more general audience, including non-specialists. Are you writing for patients, for example, right? Mm-hmm. There are other considerations. So the audience is also really important. One audience that the researchers don't think of that they're writing for is for the reviewers, in other words, their colleagues who will scrutinize the work, and of course the editors. And I don't necessarily mm-hmm. just mean editors like me, professional editors, but of course editors who are also the colleagues, so academic, so-called academic editors. And that's something else to consider. Oh, and the other important aspect is, why are you sharing this story? To me, one crucial aspect of writing a paper, which is nowadays much more prominent on everyone's mind than it was, let's say, 20 years ago when I was in the lab, and that is, researchers should think that they're sharing the story because they want others to build on it. So where I'm going with this is, you know, think about how much data, how much information about the materials and the process that led you to make your conclusions you want to share. Because ideally, I mean, no researcher wants their work to just be out there and not used by anyone. You want others to build on it, perhaps even set up new collaborations. So there's something else, to what extent you want your work to be used and what it means in terms of how you communicate it.
Great. Thank you for all those tips. And clearly, the last one was kind of something that is not really common in the mind of scientists when they think about publishing. So you were a researcher and now you are editor-in-chief. So how did this transition change, for example, your thoughts about publishing? Did something switch when you changed on the other side of the...
Did something change? It's a difficult comparison to make because... Of course, right now, I have a lot more experience to everything in life, if you like. I have read thousands and thousands of papers across different disciplines. When I was a researcher, of course, I was reading a lot of papers, but it was a little different. And of course, you know, I wrote some papers myself, but the extent of my experience was much lesser. I would say probably the most useful difference lies in the fact that I have now seen how papers evolve. I have seen the process. I have seen what you know, a paper looks like when it's submitted, how it happens that it goes through peer review. And of course, as an editor, I would choose those reviewers. But how it happens it goes through peer review, how reviewers respond to a paper and the authors respond to those comments, and that whole dynamic, and then what my role as an editor in this process is. And then I have seen the outcome that is published. We all have some kind of an insight, as you know, those of you who are listening as working researchers, you have an insight into this because effectively all of you are authors, all of you are reviewers, and a large proportion of you will be editors as well, at least at some point, even if it's just a guest editor for for an issue. And I think seeing that whole process makes you... If you're paying attention to what's happening in the process, makes you write better papers, makes you anticipate the kinds of questions, the kinds of challenges, the requirements, and actually, you know, makes you a better reviewer and makes you better editor as well. So I think that's probably the biggest difference.
Right. So it's a good experience to have and that you share with us today. And another point is, researcher fear sometimes not most of them, but researcher can fear the process of publishing. Were you one of them? And if what would you say to them, to the one that fear that?
So I think I was one of them when I worked in the lab. And what I would say, my most important message prompted by this question is actually a message to the editors. So it's a message to me. it should be incumbent on me as an editor and my colleagues and publishers and so on to make the process transparent, to make it clear what goes on during this process, how I make decisions as an editor, what comes into my consideration, what you as an author can do to help me and anybody else who reads the paper to make the system or the process flow more easily, and also to make it very clear that I'm available for a conversation. Whereas I think when I was in the lab, and you know, admittedly this was a few years ago, when I was in the lab, the reason why I was apprehensive about the process is because I didn't understand it. I didn't really know. You know, once I sent off my paper, what happened to it, and you know, it wasn't very clear. I once heard an anecdote shared with me by a researcher, a very established, prominent researcher. He used this analogy to describe what the publication process feels like to him, and I emphasize this was an accomplished researcher, published widely. He said, you know, it feels like I'm some kind of a medieval knight on a horse storming a castle, and I'm trying to throw my manuscript over the castle wall, and it gets promptly thrown out again. I don't understand the process. And I listened to this description, and I was horrified, because I thought, you know, well, in this description, in this scenario, I am the gatekeeper, the guardian on the castle walls, and that's certainly not how I want how I envisage my role as an editor. I'm more of a facilitator rather than, you know, a sort of a person who's defending some territory with whom there is no dialogue, which is implicit in that, you know, medieval analogy.
But it has become a bit of a battle, right? Because the way you started to describe your job, it's we could consider that the editor is a partner in the whole knowledge generating process, and yet it's become very adversarial. Partly, maybe you're right, partly because we don't know what happens when you click the submit, then it's sort of a black box. But it's become sort of a battle, which is the image, the medieval knight image. Do you think there's something that we can do to change that it's not such a battle, and that we all have the same, we have the same mission, which is to communicate knowledge and increase knowledge.
You know, it genuinely pains me when people say it feels like a battle, because it shouldn't. Having said that, I never said it should be easy. Of course, it depends. It depends where you want to publish, right? Clearly, there are some journals which are more selective than others. So the degree to which the process is more or less involved will depend on the venue in which you want to publish. But it should not feel like a battle, and it should not feel that you as a researcher, you know, exasperated by the process because you don't understand it, you can't communicate with the editor, and so on. Now, one thing to understand, of course, is that every single player or stakeholder in this scenario is human. So if an editor doesn't respond to you, to your email or to your call for, you know, a couple of days or so, there may be reasons for it. There may be specific circumstances. They may have just forgotten. But equally, if it's the 30th email you sent to them in, you know, over the past month, then maybe they're never going to respond to you again. I mean, you know, I don't want it to sound inappropriate, but we are, this is a human interaction. It ought to be objective, but it is a human interaction. And incidentally, in this interaction, reviewers also play a very important part. So I have a hunch, based on many years of experience as an editor, that some of this battle experience comes from trying to open a dialogue with your own colleagues who are the reviewers. And so here I would say, you know, this is my general plea as an editor. Let's be more, all of us, let's be more open to discussion. You know, a manuscript, the objective of editorial evaluation and peer review is to make a manuscript better, even if at the end of the day, that improved manuscript is published not in the original journal to which it was submitted, right? So yeah, I guess the totality of the experience has to be taken into consideration.
Is there a major mistake that you have seen many times in submitted manuscripts? Is there something you have picked up?
I mean, I wouldn't call it a mistake as such. I mean, there's certain, you know, that there are omissions, for example, you know, at Nature in particular, and indeed, you know, the other Nature research journals, we have very specific requirements for statements on data availability and, you know, materials and methods information. And omitting that information slows down the process and actually makes peer review more difficult, evaluation of the work more difficult, because very clearly, if you make certain claims and you don't provide enough supporting evidence, they may seem less robust than they really are. So it's in your own interest. But it's I suppose, an omission. There are a number of curious tendencies, I guess, let's say, in cover letters, which I've seen repeated over and over again for many years. And, you know, myself and my colleagues have given numerous presentations to research groups. I when I used to give them specifically about editorial work, I used to call them behind the scenes at Nature. So the whole idea, you know, unpackaging that black cube and showing you what happens, not just sort of center stage, but behind. And we've always shared, of course, anonymous examples saying in cover letters, which would say things like, you know, you just simply have to consider this manuscript and publish it practically without peer review because, you know, Nobel Prize winner so-and-so and excellent, you know, outstanding scientist so-and-so has told me personally that they think this is really important work. And in reality, these statements, I mean, these are empty statements. We have no way of verifying it. Also, people say different things to your face from what they may say in anonymous peer review. And really, the only outcome of this kind of statement, the only result of this kind of statement, is that the editor who reads this cover letter is unlikely to use this person as a reviewer. But I think some researchers, and because I've seen it repeated over a long time, feel that this may be a helpful addition to the cover letter, and it isn't really. So, I mean, is it a mistake? It's just an unnecessary addition.
So we had a hard time keeping the questions down because there's so many different aspects of that, and publishing is such an important way. But we're going to skirt around a bit. So one question we had is you're very active on social media and on Twitter. Actually, we met on Twitter, why do you think this is important, the Twitter sphere? And do you have examples of how scientists can use Twitter in new ways to communicate their findings?
Yes, I find, so specifically for science-related topics, I use Twitter specifically. On a personal note, I just decided to compartmentalize my social media presence. So my Facebook is my personal space. And I'm also an enthusiastic amateur potter, and so Instagram is my pottery world, my pottery social world. But Twitter is for me for research and research related topics. You know, very clearly, considering how old I am not a native in social media space. But I embraced it relatively quickly because I found that within the genetics community, it was a fantastic space to learn on a very rapid basis about papers that were being published, critiques of papers, other things. There are in the genomics community also, there are some conferences which are very famous for effectively almost having a parallel event going on in social media with the set of questions and answers and a discussion in real time unfolding on Twitter as the meeting proceeds. And so I firsthand witnessed how useful Twitter can be. You know, my own journey on Twitter was very typical. I was a lurker to begin with, and then gradually I decided to actually have a voice on Twitter, and so now I tweet. I think it's a tremendous tool. It complements fantastically different modes of communication. Very clearly, depending on the format, whether it's visual, whether it's word-based, whether it's animated or short or long, you can convey different messages and with different speed. And so Twitter really complemented. I am fascinated by constructive discussions of papers or events in science. Of course, there is a downside to it. We all know that there can be actually an ugly side to Twitter. But I like to focus on the positives. It brings people from different disciplines that wouldn't necessarily come together naturally, because people see what you tweet or you see somebody else's tweets. And, you know, it's an interesting space for researchers to come together with policymakers or you know, natural scientists to come together with social scientists. It may or may not be relevant to your work, but I think it's always interesting. One example that I always give, I'm really keen on, is storifying, doing little Twitter threads that describe a published paper. And so I've seen a number of examples of these, sometimes, you know, including papers that we've published in Nature, but of course others, where sometimes authors themselves would take their own paper and tell the story in the paper in a Twitter thread, perhaps around the figures or aspects of the figures in the paper, but not always. And what to me is particularly fascinating about it is that it enables the interested community to come in and maybe comment on different aspects of the paper very specifically, because of course you can come in at any point in the Twitter thread. It's really sort of criticism, constructive criticism and discussion of published research in action, to the point that I have seen examples of papers being retracted by the authors as a result of a mistake found in this conversation on Twitter. Now, it's interesting because, of course, we all fear retractions. They're associated with stigma, which incidentally most retractions should not be, because, of course, most retractions or many retractions are not associated with fraud or some similar behavior. But here is an example of how interaction on social media in a way that would be very difficult to emulate in another way very rapidly leads to the correction of scientific record. And, you know, the few examples that I can think of were author-prompted retractions, because as a result of that conversation in social media, they realized themselves that there were some holes in their arguments and they no longer could stand by the results.
So you touch lots of things there. Can I just pick up on the fraud so that we can get that out of the way, as it were? How do you feel, so as an editor of a very high profile journal and in a group that publishes, that has many high profile journals, how do you feel about the role of journals and editors in fraud and retractions and this whole space?
So definitely editors and journals have a very important role in contributing to setting standards for rigor in science and absolutely to keeping that record, publication record, scientific record clean. You know, we always say, and it really is very true, we do investigate every single case which comes to our attention. And there are different ways in which our attention can be drawn to something that we published. You know, after all, the reason why we all do science or engage in science is because we want to understand how things work, or we want to devise something that improves a situation or helps us analyze something or what have you. So if you think about doing science from this perspective, fraud has no place there at all, quite apart from the fact that, of course, it's an illegal activity. So absolutely, crucial role. But I think of the research environment, so from a very almost ecological perspective, it's an ecosystem, and there are different players in this ecosystem. I think collectively, researchers themselves, editors, funders, mentors, have to work together to train the next generation of scientists so that it's very clear what the scientific process is like, what's admissible, how it ought to unfold. So there is no fraud. There is no reason for it. And clearly, it's not acceptable today, but it's even less frequently encountered.
So coming back to Twitter and this idea of collective responsibility, so you talked about Twitter very much as a as a platform for discussion, for example, in the genetics community. But I wondered, in terms of collective responsibility, how you feel about the role of nature in communicating science to the larger public. And we've just been through a few months of very complicated science communication with a lot of fake news claims. How do you see a role in making sure that the general public get the right messages about the science?
Yes, it's an important question and an important consideration. Something that incidentally is really lies at the heart of our journal and our history. So, you know, Nature, last year we celebrated our 150th anniversary. And I don't know how many of the listeners will know that when Nature was first published back in 1869, it was actually going to be more like, let's say, Scientific American or New Scientist of today than a scientific journal. So the concept was that scientists would write about their discoveries, their findings for the general public. Okay. So it was a very different premise. But one of the things that I love about our history, our early history, is the fact that actually, you know, at the time, of course, publishing scientific results was very, very different. And Nature was different from everybody else in the sense that it had much simpler, much shorter format for contributions. So the scientific community, such as it was at the time, effectively hijacked our pages to communicate these findings and discoveries.
With each other.
Exactly. So I just love that aspect of our story. But when the journal was launched, there was a mission. It was a mission statement that was created for the journal. And there was an important duality to this mission statement. And that was to indeed serve the scientists, but also to communicate to the general public. And that mission statement has only changed slightly in the last 150 years. One key difference is that in the original mission statement, we talked about men of science. Needless to say, we no longer talk about men of science today. But that duality of our mission absolutely remains. So we see this communication of science, of research, as a crucial part of our role. And of course, we do so through what we call the magazine part of Nature. So the news, the shorter format, but also through our podcasts, through our YouTube channel, and indeed social media activity. I think it's absolutely important that we bring the context, we explain, and indeed, exactly as you said, over the last several months, we've seen incredible appetite for understanding science, understanding the, you know, biology, epidemiology, etc., etc. And for many, for those who don't have scientific background, really grappling with this issue, you know, what is a reliable source of information? If you don't have formal training, it's not always easy to tell. So absolutely, key role. And I would argue that everyone in the research ecosystem has that role to play or their responsibility.
So moving to something a bit more personal. So you, in the 150-year history of Nature, you're the first woman to take the helm. So how do you feel about that?
Well, so the first thing to say is a bit of context. So I'm actually only the 8th editor-in-chief of Nature. So it seems to be, you know, it's a great job. People stick around, basically. but in some sense, for historic reasons, it would have been amazing had there been women in that role in the past. But it's sort of easier to see how it was less likely to happen then. Perhaps not surprisingly, I like to focus on what I can bring to this role, not as a woman necessarily, but as the person who's been appointed in this role and because of my interests and my focus. But undoubtedly, my interest and my focus is also influenced by the fact that I'm a woman. So there's no question. I'm glad that, you know, if I try to be objective and step away from this role, I'm glad that we have someone like me, i.e. a woman, in this role. In general, I think on Nature in particular, but in general in the research ecosystem, we all need to strive towards greater representation of diverse voices. What we're trying to do, the research we're trying to do, is going to be better for it.
Do you have a precise way in mind, so how you can increase this diversity in science community?
Precise? No. I think we all probably think about a number of ways in which we can advance the change. It's important to remember that these changes never happen overnight, of course. Mm-hmm. But it's a question of, I think, mentorship, encouragement, setting examples, keeping an open mind, because diversity brings a number of different perspectives with it. And if we're too close-minded, certain types of perspectives may not seem relevant to what we're doing. And, you know, that will in turn lead to reduced diversity, or at least perpetuation of a lack of diversity. You know, in my own work as an editor, also with other editors, especially in recent times, we've been discussing it much more actively than in the past, although it has always been present on my mind, on our minds, on my mind also. But in my own work, it's a matter of being much more inclusive in my outreach, talking to diverse representatives from different parts of the world, from different disciplines, at different stages of their career, to get a perspective of what they find interesting, what they find important in research, and what they need. And then in turn, adjusting how we at Nature and other journals can best accommodate these interests. Mm-hmm.
So you've contributed to launch two prizes for women in science. So why are these important for you?
The answer to this question is complicated for me personally, because on the one hand, so let me explain what I mean by this.
We don't ask simple questions.
No, I expected nothing different. So let me explain. So on the one hand, research is a collective endeavor. Essentially, there are very few examples, and in fact, right now, I can't think of any, but I'm sure we could probably think of one or two. But by and large, overwhelming majority of research discovery happens as part of teams. And yet, I think for very human reasons, we glorify individuals in mm-hmm. the context of scientific endeavor. And prizes are a perfect example of this. You know, on the one hand, yes, we say we stand on the shoulders of giants, and the reality is we stand on the shoulders of all sorts of contributors. But then at the same time, we love these representative individuals. So there's a bit of a conflict, internal conflict in me. On the one hand, I would really like to be able to surface team effort and award teams. But at the same time, it is important to remember that individuals represent teams, and therefore by acknowledging individual effort, we can, by extension, acknowledge the ideals, their efforts, and the efforts of the teams. So the reason why this was important, these prizes, and incidentally, one of the prizes is for individuals, and the other one is either for individuals or teams or initiatives. The reason why we wanted to set up these prizes was to showcase women in science. You know, I invite anyone who's listening right now, think of a recent conference you attended. Women continue to be in the minority, especially when you come to plenary sessions or if somebody asks you for recommendations of researchers. Men still tend to be in the first few who come to mind when you think of these recommendations. And yet, there are outstanding female researchers out there, and often they are unrecognized. There are no, I think when we started that prize, there were very few, I can think of one other, awards for specifically for female researchers. Mm-hmm. And so we just wanted to amplify that voice, show examples. And in our case, you know, this year is the third year that these prizes are running. And in our cases, what's really nice is that we deliberately positioned this prize to showcase female early career researchers. They provide fantastic role models for other young women who go into mm-hmm. research. And I think that's really valuable.
Great. So thank you for sharing your thoughts about that. Moving to another topic, which is more into publishing. We often hear that colleagues claim that the current publishing system is a bit like broken. And we know that you have thoughts about innovation in scientific publishing. We all know that the publishing is sometimes time consuming and it can last like many months, which can impair a bit the career of young scientists. So what do you see as the changes ahead? Do you think publishing and peer review is broken?
So in your question, okay, I'm not going to keep you in suspense. I'm going to say that it's definitely not perfect and it definitely needs improvement, like anything mm-hmm. that we are part of or engage in. But in your question, you talked, for example, about the time that it takes to publish and careers and so on. Now, to me, when we think about these issues, we have to think about more than just publishing. We have to think about other aspects of the research ecosystem. So, you know, why does it matter? I mean, let's just consider this for a second. Why does it matter? Or why is it a problem that if you publish a paper that takes a year to publish, let's just take as an example, why is this a problem as opposed to that it takes 3 months to publish a paper? Well, it's a problem in the current system because, for example, funding cycles tend to work on 3-year cycles. But if the funding cycle worked on an annual basis, then the 3-month publication time would probably be a problem, right? It's a matter of scale. So, and just to be clear, I'm not necessarily saying that it's okay that something takes a year to publish. It depends what it is, and it depends why it takes a year. But we have to take this in the context of the whole system. I think we have to look at how researchers are evaluated, how their output is evaluated. If, as it has been for many, many years historically, they're only evaluated on the publication record, then that's not a healthy system. Because if you think about what a researcher does, publishing papers is a very important part of what they do, but it's definitely not the only thing that they do. Yeah, you know, sure. Many of the things we discussed already, contributing to peer review, editing journals, curating data, sharing data, mentoring, all of this is a super important aspect of being a researcher and having actually a fulfilling career as a researcher. And yet, to this day, even though we increasingly talk about it, very few aspects of this come into play when individuals are evaluated, you know, for another position or for tenure, et cetera, et cetera. Now, with the publishing system, I think we all agree that peer review, for example, is imperfect. I think there's no question about it. We all agree about this. The really tricky situation is there isn't a perfect alternative yet. Some alternatives work for some researchers better than others. Some disciplines have particularly embraced one type of peer review as opposed to another. You know, at Nature, for example, we had some interesting, we've sort of done experiments and, you know, I sort of say it in inverted commas because they were not truly controlled necessarily, but they were sort of little experimentation voyages to see whether the research community was interested in other types of peer review. For example, in the sort of mid-2000s, we had, or even early 2000s, we had a trial running which, alongside traditional peer review, encouraged our authors to effectively do like open peer review. So collect comments from the community openly and submit those comments to us so we can evaluate them in parallel with the formal, if you like, traditional single-blinded peer review. It's possible that we ran that trial too early in this sort of evolution of our collective thinking, but there was essentially no uptake. We actually closed the trial before it's run its full course because there was no uptake for it. There is, of course, difference of opinion as to whether naming reviewers is helpful and who is it helpful to, right? Many early career researchers say, you know, for me as an early career researcher, it would be really difficult to put my name to a review and be really honest if on a particular occasion I'm evaluating a paper of a very senior researcher in my field and I feel I need to be critical of this work, right? So, I mean, these are all very familiar examples. So I see the current level of discussion about the need for innovation in the publishing sphere, but also in the research community, for example, innovation in researcher evaluation, innovation in research culture more broadly, I think the level of discussion is really, really encouraging. And I strive for us at Nature to be part of this discussion because I do think we have a role to play there. I'm hoping that the more we discuss, the more we trial, and of course, you know, we can't trial everything on Nature, but there are other journals, other systems which are using different approaches. I think this way, hopefully over time, new trends and new directions will emerge.
So that's interesting. We're clearly in a point where there's a need to experiment, and we haven't found alternative metrics, or in some way everyone says, well, all the others have to change as well, the recruiting panels and the evaluating panels and the funding panels, and so the publishing is part of that. But nonetheless, you are the editor of the journal with the highest impact factor, one of the highest impact factors. One of the highest and I work in a country where impact factors are very important to selection committees, and it can really make or break a career getting into that through that black box. How do you feel about? I mean, even on a personal level, as an editor, you're having a massive impact on people's careers, whether you feel that the recruiting committees are dealing with it intelligently or not. So how do you feel about that as a carrier of one of those high impact factors? And what could the alternative metrics be? Do you have some ideas of the alternative metrics?
So in answer to the first part of your question, of course, all editors are very aware of the responsibility that they carry on their shoulders, which is why, you know, when we recruit editors, we do it with great diligence. We are looking for people who are very aware, as objective as possible, and who are conscientious, because there is a responsibility. I mean, there is a responsibility to every journal, but I appreciate that some journals are more prominent and more visible. So absolutely, we take this responsibility very, very seriously. The impact factor, I mean, it has been said many times, but I will say it again. The impact factor is a measure which was devised for librarians to decide which journals to subscribe to or renew. It's a shortcut for evaluating a journal, right? It's an average number of citations given to a paper over a period of time on a sliding window. And it's a measure of a journal. It should never be a measure of a paper, individual paper in the journal, let alone the researcher who's published, who has, after all, published in a number of other journals as well, right? Because, of course, when one looks at a researcher's career CV, you see a number of different publications. I would say even more that impact factors, again, I doubt that I'm saying anything that's surprising, but I think it's worth reiterating this. Impact factors are a property of a field, of a domain, right? So an impact factor of 10 may be enormous in one discipline, but okay in another. Which leads to an interesting observation, which I will make and I have made before in public, is that an impact factor for a multidisciplinary journal such as Nature is an interesting oddity, because what exactly does it mean? And of course, we are not the only multidisciplinary journal. And actually, just one other example to explore this sort of absurdity of our obsession with impact factors. You know, if you're a researcher who is working on, let's just pick a field which has high citation levels, right now, materials chemistry, devising new materials for energy storage, very active field, very high citation levels. If you compare that with, I don't know, theoretical or a maths paper. Publishing in a journal such as Nature, if you're part of the former category, you might actually not be maximizing your impact factor count, if you like, because there possibly are journals out there with a higher impact factor that are more specialty journals that you could have submitted to. But if you're in the latter group, then your whole sort of sphere of journals, your specialist journals, completely in a different level on the sliding scale of impact factor. So I think the more you think about it, the more you realize that transposing impact factor, which is a property of a journal, to an individual researcher, an individual paper, makes no sense on any level whatsoever. Mm-hmm. And mercifully, we are moving away from this. I mean, we ourselves at Nature, Springer Nature as a publisher, you know, we've now officially as a whole publishing group joined DORA, so signed DORA, I should say. So San Francisco Declaration of Research Assessment. So we don't promote our impact factors. We of course list them on our pages, but importantly, along with a number of other metrics, but we no longer promote these impact factors. And I'm actually kind of proud to say that I know what Nature's impact factor is more or less, but not exactly. You know, I it's not that important. You asked me about alternative metrics.
Yeah.
To me, very clearly, at the moment, we already have alt metrics, so alternative metrics, looking at citations to the paper, reactions from the wider community, social media, impact on policy, if that's relevant, broad coverage in the media otherwise. I think there are some other metrics that we are increasingly thinking about, and I mean we as a community, but we should consider more in the future. For example, transparency of reporting, openness of sharing data and other materials. Where appropriate, inclusive publishing. You know, think of two papers that you compare, which publish results on a topic which is relevant to a specific patient group. You may, as a distinguishing factor between these papers, you may consider, well, is one paper purely sort of quote unquote academic without in any way steeping the results in the context of the patient groups and their needs and comments, as opposed to another which is much more inclusive and engaging with those communities and directly relating those results to the real outcome. Now, this is a specific example. It will not be applicable to all of them. But these kinds of metrics or ways of evaluating of research, I think, are important. And also importantly, when we evaluate researcher contribution, we have to move beyond papers. We have to think about some of the other things that I mentioned before in terms of data curation, collaborations, mentorship, etc., etc.
Okay, I know that you've said these things before, but I think it's important to underline them. Even this week, I heard someone talk about an algorithm that takes the impact factor and multiplies it by your position in the paper and the number of authors. So people are still
really?
Playing. People are still playing with this. Yeah. I actually don't know what your impact factor is. I just know it's probably high. So you just said we're exploring different things, different types, and I think it is exploration, and I don't think the jury's out about what works and what doesn't work. And as you said, it may be very community specific. So, for example, physicists have been using open archives for many years. Biologists are beginning to play with a bioarchive. How do you feel about that? How do you feel about the use of these archives? If I want to be more controversial, do you think the journal is dead?
No, of course not. So you know, Nature is actually a good example of a journal which has coexisted, I think, very successfully with a preprint archive model. So indeed, as you said, archive, the original preprint server, is more than two decades old. And since we've been publishing physical sciences papers really for the last 150 years, we've been completely fine. And we see our publication in the journal as being completely compatible and, in fact, complementary with the effort of publishing preprints. I think it's very interesting and very positive that the life sciences community has now, over the past 10 years or so, embraced the preprint model as well. Interestingly, over the past months during the COVID pandemic, we've seen the medical and clinical community now embrace the model. And you know, we have at Nature Research, in fact, the whole Springer Nature, we have deliberately asked our authors to deposit a preprint for every COVID-related submission. In fact, we mandated during the pandemic, because it's so important that this type of research at a time of pandemic is made available without any delay. And of course, the crucial difference lies indeed in peer review. Peer-reviewed papers can turn out to be wrong, but they have gone through peer review, and of course no system is infallible and so on. But preprints are the sort of a different step, a complementary way of disseminating information. And in my conversations with the research community, I always hear that it's a kind of feedback that, that you get from the community. You deposit your preprint, you get the feedback from the community, which allows you to revise maybe before you submit, or revise at a later stage if you're doing, if you're depositing your preprint in parallel with submission to a journal. But most emphatically, it's a complementary way of sharing your papers or your statements, your stories, to come back to what we were saying in the, at the very beginning. I don't think a journal is dead at all because of the preprints. In fact, plenty of evidence that journals have coexisted very successfully with preprint servers.
Another question from a bit another side of the system of publishing, but have you ever considered paying scientific authors in royalties, such as other publishing models? Is this something that have come to mind, to journals or something like that?
Have I ever? No. Has it been considered in journal publishing? Possibly. I couldn't say that. If I try to imagine whether that system would work, I find it hard to imagine that this would work in any way. I mean, of course, authors of books, for example, get royalties, but this works very differently in commissioned overview work. It's a very different dynamic and different interaction. But in terms of primary research, I guess, is an extension of the research itself. So it's as I see the process as a continuum, right? Investigation, setting up hypotheses, experiments, what have you, analyses, collecting data, analyses, and then publishing. So that's a continuum. And that, so paying for one part of it specifically would I find it hard to imagine. Yeah. Mm.
So just to wrap up, so we as I said, we could go on for hours. Publishing is so much part of our job. But talking about something that people thought was impossible and became a reality, I've been involved for many years in the open access movement, and now people are paying to publish. So how do you feel about the role that nature plays in this debate about open access publishing?
So relatively recently, you know,
it's a big question. I know it's
huge, a huge question.
We could do a whole podcast on that.
How long do we have? So as you know, recently, I'm going to say within the last 4 to 6 weeks, our publisher, Springer Nature, made a statement that indeed Nature and other Nature research journals will be offering open access option within our pages, and in fact will become transformative journals as defined by Coalition S. I mean, very clearly, I hope you didn't expect any other answer apart from the fact that I think open access to scientific literature is important. I want to emphasize that it's only one part of opening up science. Again, it's an obvious thing to say. Collectively, we spend a lot of time talking about open access. I think we should be extending this discussion more and more to other aspects of science. If we really think about getting return on investment, quote unquote, for money that's spent on science, in the end, it's actually the data, the products of science, you know, the code, the data, the materials, the what have you, that the reuse of which will lead to real investment, return on investment. So I think it's great that we've been working for a long time now on open access, but let's extend this to other aspects of science. For Nature, it will mean a different way of working to ensure that we are able to focus on what, by we, I mean editors, to ensure that the editors are able to focus on the only thing that they have to focus, and that is excellent science, exciting science, and elegant science. It's a really, really interesting time to be an editor of a journal. We will see how this unfolds. Of course, Nature is only one of the journals that's going through this transition and is part of this change. I'm glad that we will be moving along, as opposed to, you know, staying with the model which we have at the moment. But I really hope that we don't lose the focus on other aspects of open science. We've done some work in this space to support our authors in sharing. And I very much hope, I certainly want to, and that's what I will drive for, that we will continue that work as well.
Right. So there, as I said, there are lots of things we didn't touch on. It is a field that everyone, every working scientist in whatever discipline has an opinion about publishing. And there is a lot of frustration. And if I hear correctly, I like the idea that publishers and editors will be partners in trying to explore different ways of doing this, and that we'll get it right together. We're going to take a short break, and then we're going to come back and hear more about Magdalena and a little less about publishing.
Hey folks, don't run away. You're listening to The Lonely Pipette with Renaud Pourpre and Jonathan Weissman, where our goal is to help scientists do better science.
If you're enjoying the show and you want to learn more, you can follow us on Twitter at Lonely Pipette. And please share the podcast with your friends.
If you don't want to miss any of our future episodes, you can subscribe to our mailing list and join our community. Click on the subscription link on our Twitter account.
It's as simple as that. Take a few moments to get more tips from the Lonely Pipette.
So welcome back after the break. Welcome back to the Lonely Pipette. And after the break, we want to hear a little bit more personal about Magdalena. So we're going to start really easy, with a simple question. Do you have, so you're doing lots of things. Do you have a morning routine? What does the beginning of the day look like for Magdalena?
A ritual, something.
Yeah. I do not. This is the worst part of this conversation, you realize, revealing my inner secrets. I am not a very routine-driven person, unfortunately. I wish I was. I suppose the only part of my morning routine is a cup of coffee. Nothing happens before a cup of coffee.
So we heard that you were a potter and that you have a passion for languages, and so is there something else that what would people be surprised to hear about you?
Oh, I'm not sure whether people will be surprised to hear. I guess another aspect that's important to me is travel in order to understand other cultures and other aspects of humanity, I guess. So the older I get when I travel, the more important it is that I travel to meet people as opposed to travel to see places. Uh-huh. That's become quite an important theme, you know, something that I enjoy enormously and I find really enriching personally.
Okay, and so I said we wouldn't talk about publishing, but I am interested. What do you think makes a good editor? What makes you a good editor? Someone who's thinking about going into science publishing.
There is an implicit assumption in your question. So what makes a good editor? A number of attributes. Obviously, a good editor has to be knowledgeable in their discipline. They have to be open-minded. They have to be able to listen. They must be as objective as possible. And I say it deliberately this way because, of course, nobody is completely objective, but striving, realizing that this objectivity is really important. A good editor is a good diplomat. I think you have to balance many different interests and different opinions. It's actually a surprisingly people's focused job as well as a job of scrutinizing science and so on. And a good editor has to be able to make decisions, which is not always easy. Not everybody finds it easy to make decisions. It's important that an editor makes decisions, but it's even more important that they can clearly articulate the reasons for those decisions.
So you're a biologist. Can you do you read all the other articles, the physics and the geology and the astrophysics? How do you, because you have this wonderfully broad journal?
Yes.
Which prides itself on its breadth, but most people are just dipping in to read a little bit of it. How do you feel about that?
So maybe it would be helpful to actually explain what I do in my role and what I don't do in my role. Okay. And one of the things that I don't do in my role, most emphatically, is read the papers. It's actually humanly impossible because, nature receives something like 12,000 papers a year, right? Wow. So it's actually not possible for anyone to read, let alone understand the papers. And you know, to be brutally honest and perfectly clear, I am in no position to evaluate a newly submitted manuscript in particle physics
but even after the peer review, the things that you publish,
yep,
you are the editor of a journal of which I imagine many of the articles you cannot understand, right?
Yes.
How do you feel about that?
I certainly cannot understand.
How do you deal with that?
Yes. So I certainly cannot understand the papers at the level of appreciating the true novelty that specific manuscript brings, because of course I don't have the necessary background in a number of the disciplines. So when you work on any team, and you can think of it as an analogy, think of your own lab, as your research progresses, it's not uncommon that your findings take you in a direction that you're not an expert in, and maybe you will bring a new postdoc to the lab who brings new expertise to augment the research that you're doing. You will understand the technology and technique and the analysis and what have you, what this postdoc is using to some extent, but you're not the expert, right? So there's a bit of an analogy there. I work with a very experienced team of editors, each of whom is an expert in that discipline, each of whom did original research in that discipline. So you build, as you work with colleagues, you build a level of trust and you have discussions. And of course, I don't discuss every single paper with my colleagues, but they discuss in smaller groups. Some papers I would be involved in a discussion of, and so on. So it's a matter of trust, of professionalism and experience of the colleagues I work with. I try to read every paper when it's published or when it's accepted. And exactly as you said, some papers I read in more depth and I appreciate in more depth. And it's much, much easier for me to do this within life sciences than it is within physical sciences. And some disciplines are more of a closed book to me than others. But one of the really fascinating things about this role is how the opportunity to learn across different disciplines. And this is actually, I think this is an opportunity not just for me as an editor, as the editor of the journal, but an opportunity for any reader of a multidisciplinary journal. This cross-fertilization from one discipline to another, even in the way you ask questions, not just methodologies, but even if you ask questions, what questions you pursue, can be really instructive and can reinvigorate someone's research. So that's how I feel about leading a journal where I am not an expert in every single aspect that we publish. It is a team effort.
I mean, you are right that we are all publishing papers now where it's unlikely that any single author masters everything that went into the paper. So we all have this sort of team trust, but it's not always easy.
Exactly. But it's also the way that papers are reviewed, of course, right? So the reviewers are invited to comment on specific aspects of papers because it's increasingly harder to anticipate that any one person will have the necessary depth, experience, and so on. But yes, we do have to trust one another. And of course, it takes time to build up trust and so on. But yeah.
What is a particular achievement you're the most proud of?
Clearly, there isn't one that springs to mind immediately. There are a number of events throughout my life that were really instrumental, and there were really sort of key moments when I felt very proud of myself. You know, I'll be very honest. I was very proud, incredibly honored, and really humbled when I was appointed into this role.
Nervous?
Oh yeah. I'm still very nervous. This doesn't go away. I was very excited and very proud when I got my PhD position in Cambridge. I thought this was terrific, and I remember that excitement. I was very proud when I finally learned to ice skate and my dad didn't have to hold my hand anymore, right? So there's a whole kind of collection of events throughout my life that I've been proud of.
Do you hear yourself introducing yourself as the editor of Nature and say, oh, that's me? Is there ever an imposter syndrome?
Oh, there's always an imposter syndrome. I think I like to think that everyone suffers from an imposter syndrome, at least to some extent. And of course, mm-hmm. you know, I do as well. So I do, you know, I'm clearly comfortable in this role and I feel that I have something to contribute. But this doesn't mean that in any way that I rest on any laurels ever. You know, it's an ongoing process. An ongoing opportunity, actually, which is the beauty of the role, the learning, the growing opportunity.
Do editors have mentors? Were you mentored throughout your career as an editor?
No. So, there isn't a formal system, of course. Mentorship is an interesting concept. I mean, there are settings in which there is formal mentoring, but as often as, well, I have at least found that while the official formal mentorship can be helpful, it's different at many, many levels from when you find your own mentor in life. And that person can be a mentor in your personal life and or professional life at a certain point in time, what have you. But there isn't a formal system. I mean, there is to some extent, but I think not at the level that you're asking sort of overarching guidance.
It doesn't have to be formalized. So when you do a PhD, it's clear your mentor is to some extent, the PI who's responsible for you. But then lots of us, and this is a theme that we've seen with a lot of the people we've talked to, is that they've had different mentors for different parts of their life and different parts of their careers.
Yes.
And I just wondered how much mentoring there is in the editorial publishing world.
Yeah.
And do you see yourself as a mentor?
So I'd like to think that's I'm a mentor. I'm aware of the fact that there have been mentor-mentee relationships that have formed in my past where I was doing the mentoring. You know, it's a great privilege to realize that somebody sort of adopted you in that way and they value your guidance and your insight. But I myself learn quite a lot from it. There is a concept which I only learned about relatively recently, and I've become quite fascinated by it, and that is this concept of reverse mentoring. So that, you know, as an established person, personally, professionally, you become mentored by somebody who is much younger, much more junior. I think it's such a terrific idea, and so I'm really interested in you know, even if it's not a formal in any formal sense mentoring, I'm certainly interested in learning from people whose perspectives are different by virtue of, you know, the stage in life, personal and professional.
That's why we're doing this podcast two-way, so that we're bringing very different perspectives.
Yes, yeah, that's exactly this reason.
Right.
And yeah, because we think that this is like, it doesn't have to be formal to find a mentor, but you can just like find mentoring different place and time, and this is just growing you at every stage of your life. And so now, can you tell us, you talk about imposter syndrome, but maybe this is not a major fear maybe that you had in your career. Did you have a fear in your career, and how did you overcome it? Sorry,
I'm not sure I've had a major fear in my career as such. There've been obviously difficult times, difficulties, challenges. Mm-hmm. I think everybody experiences that. To be honest, when you asked me a question, what came to mind was an experience from school.
Mm-hmm.
I remember very clearly when I was maybe 11 or 12, I had a very, very fierce maths teacher. And and the, you know, I was...
You never forget them, right? No.
Mathematics are terrific for everybody, I think.
and so the interesting challenge there was, you know, at that point at school, I was a very good student. I loved learning. It wasn't really a problem. But on maths, I had to spend a bit more time. And this was a new teacher, arrived at school. I was terrified, absolutely terrified, especially because I knew that, you know, the subject wasn't a walk in the park for me. And I remember this very clearly. I was so afraid. I actually didn't want to go to school, which was very unusual for me because I loved going to school for learning and social reasons and so on. And there I actually remember very clearly my dad sitting me down and walking me through the whole scenario and to like dissect, you know, why are you afraid? What is it that you fear? And he basically said, you know, I think the best way, considering what you told me, the best way to deal with this is to go really prepared to the class and know your stuff and be able to answer. So, but effectively, you know, behave like a professional pupil, if you like. So you've done your homework, you've done your work. And then if you don't understand something, this is not shameful. You can just say to your teacher, well, I don't understand. And this was fantastic advice. You know, it just, it somehow eliminated or allowed me to rise above the emotional part of this mm-hmm. situation and so focus on the factual aspects. So that was the first thing that came to my mind when you talked about fear.
Yeah. No, but that's great. I think this is a process that everybody can apply a different step in their life. I mean, just face it and just the step, different step. And this is a really analytic method, yes. But I kind of like it. Yeah.
Yes.
Can you think of bad recommendations that you've heard over the years? Things that you heard people say in the scientific community, you think, oh dear, no, that's really not good advice.
I guess the only thing that comes to mind, so I'm not sort of flooded with examples, but the only thing that comes to mind is something that I think mercifully happens less and less often, and it's this concept in some researchers' minds that unless you stay in academic career, you have failed. I think this is an incorrect opinion, and actually, I think quite a bad thing to say to a young person who is at that point in the research environment, in the research career, thinking about what next. There are so many paths to success and so many definitions of success.
And no normal careers.
No, there are no normal careers. And you know, the good thing is that, you know, today we realize there's so much more. You know, we're talking about non-linear careers, for example, right? Which again makes them more inclusive, makes that success more inclusive, more attainable for different people, people who start later in life, people who take a break for whatever reason, people who, yeah, just many different sort of recipes. But I think this is the key. Success has so many different faces, and it has to be defined by the person in question. Because in the end, if everybody else thinks you're successful but you're not happy with what you're doing, that is hardly success.
Yeah.
So you talked about yourself as a child in school. If you were to go back 20 years, if you were to meet yourself 20 years ago, what advice would you give yourself?
Oh, keep an open mind, even more of an open mind than I had then. I think it's interesting. So this is going to be a very personal comment now.
That's great.
I've always considered myself as a bit of a slow developer. So I get there eventually, but it takes me a while to realize certain things. And I think if I met my younger self, you know, especially in my sort of early 20s, I think I would just say, like, look to the side, look over here, look over there, you know, talk to all these different people. There are so many different possibilities. I think that would probably be the most important piece of advice. And the other thing I would say, something which I think comes to us all as we move on through life, is you are your own harshest critic and you have to satisfy yourself. So, you know, make sure that what you do, how you do it, is okay with you first.
So we are beginning to wrap up because it's been a long and super great talk with you. Thank you again. And so where can people find out more about you if people want to know more about you and your work? Do you have anything you want to share with us and to our listeners?
Well, I mean, I would say if somebody wants to find out more about my work or editorial work, then there are actually quite a few, in my opinion, quite useful resources on the Nature pages. Specifically for last year's 150th anniversary, we spent quite a lot of time talking about ourselves, how we work, what we do. And so there are great testimonials from me and a number of my colleagues what we do, what we like about it, what it's like. So that's one nice way of looking at a whole gamut of different roles in science publishing.
That's great. We'll put that in the show notes.
Great. Wonderful.
We'll link to that. Yeah.
Yeah.
And also, I mean, if you're interested in asking me any questions or anything in particular, I am very easy to find. My email address is on the Nature's website, on Twitter. You know, I'll be happy to engage if somebody's particularly interested. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Great. Good. So thank you very much. We hope, we hope Nature will help us to diffuse this to as wide an audience as possible. So I know you have your own podcast series, but we feel there aren't that many resources really like this, really taking the time to have a conversation. And thank you on behalf of everyone for all the work you do. Mm-hmm. So, we hope that you'll take Nature into lots of interesting new avenues. And I have had the privilege to have published in Nature. I've also had the privilege to have been rejected many times from Nature. But it's been great. It's been great to give this platform for you to share your views. And I hope you'll come to Paris and we can do this live one time.
Thank you. I would very much like that. Thank you very much.
Thank you for listening this first part. Many thanks to Magdalena for her time and availability. Now, here's the second discussion recorded in January 2021 about the recent events at the end of 2020.
We wanted to have you back because since we recorded with you, a few things have happened around Nature, and we just wanted to have a chance to clarify and to give you a platform to hear how you respond to those things that have happened. So thanks very much for coming back. So we particularly wanted to talk to you about open access, obviously, and there are two questions we wanted to talk about. But before we start, perhaps you can just clarify for us what is the relationship between Nature editorial team and the publisher, the Springer Nature publisher, in terms of the announcements around open access.
Sure. So, in very simple terms, the relationship between us as editors and the publisher, Springer Nature, of course, the publisher publishes Nature, the publisher is our employer. When you think about the second part of your question, I think can be answered in two ways. When I think about open access, and I think many of us within the research community, we think about it from two perspectives mainly. One is a principle of disseminating communicating scientific results. And the other one is a business model which underpins the payments, if you like, of the costs that are associated with publishing. Thinking about it in those terms, both the editors and the publisher, if you like, very much support the principle of disseminating scientific information in this open way. In terms of the business model, the editors are not involved in setting up the business model, although, of course, they contribute information to it. We're all part of the same research ecosystem, if you like.
So thanks for clarifying that. And so we wanted to talk to you about two things, which are about how decisions are made. The first is, and we talked, when we first talked to you, we talked a lot about the interaction between the journals and the journal editors and the scientific community. And there are two events over the last few months that have sparked a lot of reaction from the scientific community. So the first is there was a recent paper published in Nature Communications about the mentor-mentee relationship. And this paper precipitated a lot of reaction from the scientific community. Some of it clearly, some of it technical, some of the criticisms were technical and some of them were not. And a lot of that discussion was on Twitter and that's what brought it to my attention. And then there was an editorial decision and eventually a retraction by the authors. And so it's raised obviously questions about mentoring, which we're very interested in, but it also raised questions about the role of editors
in making those sort of decisions about what's published. And I'd just like to give you an opportunity to clarify some of those issues.
Thank you. I can very easily answer your questions without any reference to that paper at all, because, okay, of course, your questions are general. I can also make a comment about that particular paper and the process and the story as it unfolded, if you like. So the first question you asking, what is the relationship between editors and decisions of publishing papers? The editors are those who make those decisions. So the process for any editor on any journal, it is the editor who will make a decision armed with the information provided by the reviewers, whether a paper can be and ought to be published or not. And of course, broadly speaking, the way this process unfolds is that a manuscript is submitted to a journal, the editor will consider this manuscript, and at that point, the first decision is being made. In the case of the journals in the Nature portfolio, it would be, of course, is this paper in scope for a particular journal? Is it of interest to the readership? Does it meet the editorial bar for consideration in the broadest sense that the editor considers a given paper? When the answer is in the affirmative to these questions, then of course the editor will proceed to select appropriately qualified reviewers. And it's with that technical, if you like, in-depth information that the reviewers provide, armed with that, the editor will make a decision whether to reject a manuscript at that point or give an opportunity to the authors to revise. And that, of course, is a very standard process, which applies to, as I say, any journal, not just Nature branded journals. Now, you mentioned your other question was about mentorship. The mentorship, of course, ought to be recognized to much greater extent than it is currently in the research ecosystem. It's absolutely fundamental. I think it's fundamental in any walk of life, professional or personal, actually. But of course, in the research, in the context of the research community, we all appreciate, we all know how important mentorship is. You know, to give you an example, and it's so gratifying to see when mentorship is effective. One example I'll give you of this: for some 10 years now in Nature Research, we've had an annual Mentoring in Science Award. And just in at the end of last year, we awarded these awards. We have two categories, one lifetime and one sort of mid-career award. And I was sort of the chair of the jury who evaluated the nominations. And I have to say, it was one of the highlights of my December to look at the nominations, to look at those considerations. And of course, when one looks at these nominations and looks at the individual stories, it's actually also a great learning experience, taking, in some way, it's a mentoring experience in itself, taking a leaf from the book of the others.
So I will add something about that. I will thank you, actually, for these mentoring awards. So I, as far as I understand, they're almost country by country each year. And a few years ago, I was privileged to be able to nominate my mentor, Moshe Yaniv, who actually won the prize. Mm-hmm. And the process of putting together that package, so I contacted all his previous mentees, was fantastic. A fantastic experience and really a privilege for all the mentees to be able to acknowledge the input that their mentor had had. And it raised lots of issues for all of us about how we mentor mm-hmm. our own mentees. So I acknowledge, I thank Nature for raising the issue of mentoring. But I want to come back to the specifics of this paper, and we can discuss or not the technicity of the statistical analysis, which has been questioned. We could also discuss the validity of the conclusions of the authors. But the issue that maybe interests me more is what was the role of the reaction of the community to the fate of this paper?
Well, I think the role is very clear, and it's a very important role, right? So, of course, we all know that the paper we're discussing has been retracted, as you say, by it was an author-led retraction, as we sort of in this sort of publishing jargon refer to it. But indeed, it was the authors who retracted.
But with an editorial comment as well.
Yes, that's correct. And so, of course, when a paper is published, there is a joint responsibility because, of course, the authors submitted a paper to a journal, and the journal and the authors take that paper through peer review, through editorial evaluation, and at some point they become convinced that that paper is worthy publication. Otherwise, of course, it would not have appeared in the first place. But as we all know, science is a continuum. A paper, whether or not it's attractive, whether it's published, is not the end of any story. Stories continue to evolve and we build upon. Community feedback from the research community is absolutely crucial. And this is a good case to illustrate it. We're interested in that feedback. If omissions were made, mistakes were made, if anything needs to be corrected, and of course it doesn't necessarily need to be a retraction, it may be a correction or an addendum. There are many different variations on this theme. Nevertheless, they're all important. So papers are not published and don't exist in a vacuum. They, of course, come out there for the community to react to and respond, and then for us in turn to respond to these comments, and in this case, criticism. So as is explained in the editorial comment, in the editorial that is associated with that paper in Nature Communications, the editors took it very seriously. There was a very in-depth process of evaluation, re-evaluation, discussion with the authors, additional review, and all of that is documented on the website. From my perspective, I think it's an important illustration of how dynamic that process is, and that we actually have to be open and transparent about how our position, and by our, I mean all of us, not just editors or just authors or just reviewers, but the whole community, how that position can evolve when new interpretation, new information come to light.
So just trying to understand what you're saying, do you think they had underestimated the reaction or the impact that those conclusions might have?
By they who did.
Sorry, the editor who made the decision to publish. So you before, you said the editor decides whether something can be published and whether it ought to be published. The reviewer's comments allow them to decide whether it can be published. And then there's an additional level of editorial decision whether it ought to be published. And as I understand, some of the readers had raised the question whether this paper, whether, even if it could have been published, ought to have been published.
Right. So let's abstract from this particular case.
Okay.
Because I think the question you ask me is actually a very important one. But in order to answer it fully, I think we have to step away from a specific example.
I can think of other examples in the past around, for example, genetics and race. I mean, there are lots of examples of papers that have been published.
Absolutely. So the question that you ask is an important one, but when we qualify whether something ought to be published, even though it's correct and the conclusions are supported by provided evidence, whether we consider whether it ought to be published or not, we have to ask according to what criteria. And I think that's why I think it's important to consider that question in the abstract, because whether you consider this question in the context of ethical norms or morality or a specific preference, the answer will be different in different setting, be it through time, geography, culture, etc., etc.
Exactly.
So we have to be very careful when we make, I think now we're talking about a judgment call, which is separate from making a decision based on whether the conclusion is supported by the evidence supplied in a given paper. It's a very complex issue, of course.
Okay. So we'd like to pass to another issue, which is also fueled lots of debate among the scientific community, which is open access.
So the other issue we wanted to raise is around open access, and we wanted to talk to you more about your new open access policy that Nature has published in last November, I think, and that will apply in 2021, I think, if I may make no mistake. So we will come to that, but first, I think it's we were thinking it's really important first that maybe if you can explain what is some concepts, for example, what is the difference between gold open access compared to green open access, because it might not be really clear for some people.
Sure, of course. So first of all, perhaps another step back to explain or qualify a difference between open access and free access, because that's also sometimes not quite clear and misunderstood. So free access, of course, is free to read. So, for example, our news stories in the Nature magazine are free to read. And so, you know, my proverbial grandfather could read it on the bus, right? There's no requirement for any subscription or being accessing the material through a network of an institution or library or anything like this. So that's free to read, free access. Open access is an extended term which includes a definition of the license under which material is published. So free access often has some kind of a license restriction, not necessarily copyright withholding, but some kind of a license to publish that the author gives to the publisher. Open access is not associated with this, and most common open access today is open access under Creative Commons license. And the most permissive Creative Commons license allows another person to reproduce this work. As long as they attribute the work to the original author, they can reproduce it in any way. The license which we use within Nature Portfolio and actually at Springer Nature is the CC BY license, which is the most permissive license. So effectively, if you wanted to, for example, you could resell it also. It's as I say, most permissive license. Now, the difference between green and gold is the CC BY license open access, which is immediately available upon publication. And this is the publisher's version, the version of record, which is published under that license. Green open access is referred to as self-archiving by authors. Most journals will facilitate or be compatible with authors self-archiving, for example, in PubMed Central or another repository, sometimes repository of their own institution, their own version of the manuscript, but often 6 months or 12 months after the work has been published. So that, in essence, is the difference.
Thank you. I think it was really clear. And so to give it also a little bit of context is, can you tell our listener what is the Plan S movement and how it impacted Nature decision?
So Plan S is a plan which was put in place by Coalition S, which essentially, for a full definition and full history, perhaps you should interview one of the members of Coalition S, but just very briefly to say, I suppose the way I see Plan S was an intention to accelerate open access publishing with the emphasis on gold open access across the science publishing ecosystem. Broadly speaking, Coalition S is comprised mainly of funders of research who have come forward to say they support open access, that they will encourage and effectively mandate the researchers they support to publish their research open access, and they will also support them financially to do so in going forward.
So this movement that has been gaining some strength, what were the basis for this Nature decision that were created since the release of the decision of Plan S movement? What was the origin story a bit of this?
Open access as a principle has been around for a long time. I'm going to say, you know, probably 20 years or so. And if you think about advocates of open access, PLOS, for example, comes to mind. I mean, PLOS was founded almost 20 years ago, I think, to advance and popularize the notion that research should be published open access. So Coalition S accelerated and put more, sort of charted a more formal path by working together with actually publishers, both the sort of large, major large publishers, but also smaller publishers, accelerated a path towards open access. And so from our perspective and perspective of the publishers such as Springer Nature, it was a point in time when it was felt that there was enough of a momentum that we wanted to contribute to it within the Nature portfolio. I have to say that other imprints within Springer Nature have already been offering open access. And of course, very notably, two journals within the Nature portfolio, Nature Communications and Scientific Reports, are entirely open access journals. And there are also other journals, the communications journals, which are also entirely open access. But it was that acceleration of interest and the momentum that has precipitated the thinking on the part of the publisher to now begin to think how open access can be offered on Nature and the Nature Research Journals.
So there has been a debate, as you say, for many years. So PLOS and Biomed Central played central roles in pushing this model and then in lobbying the publishers together with universities and as you say, funders. But there has been a feeling that the progress has been too slow and there's been a lot of frustration with the fact that scientific discoveries and results that are funded by public money are behind a paywall. So you seem to acknowledge that the movement has finally caught up with the public, has finally gained enough momentum that the publishers are willing to hear that. There's been an outcry at the price that was announced, I think, by the publisher, which we'd like to understand where that comes from and how you respond to that. So I don't think anyone has a problem with the idea that publishing has a cost and that someone has to pay the costs. Either it's the reader or the producer. We can discuss which of those, but the whole community seems to accept the idea that the author pays model. But the question then is, how much does the author pay? And we see now a market in which the prices are very, very different across different journals. How do you respond to that?
So first of all, I would question what you said, that it should be the author who pays. I think, when we talk about the cost, the payment for open access, we talk about a payment which is called APC. And this APC stands for Article Processing Charge. It does not stand for author pays. Okay. And I'm not quite sure what C might stand okay. for in this definition.
I'm not suggesting that the author pays from their own pocket. But what I'm thinking is that the article that is sent to you by an author, that the production of that content is paid by the person who produces the content. So, of course, it's the university and the funder and the research or the research structure. It's not the author himself, but it is the producer of the content that pays.
Yeah. So I think you said something which is really crucial, and that is, of course, there is a cost to publishing. And different journals, different publishers have a different approach to offering a service to the authors who come to them with their manuscripts. When I think about what we offer across the Nature portfolio, we work with the authors on extensive revisions through which we guide them with the help of the reviewer comments. We mediate between authors and the reviewers. We work with the community to devise support structures that allow them to surface the quality and the rigor of the work. Things such as, for example, our reporting summaries that surface methodology that was being applied to the work that was done, surfaced the data, any other research objects that are associated with the research. There is a tremendous amount of work on the part of the editors that goes into working with the authors to shape the paper up to the acceptance. And of course, on Nature, then subsequently, there is an awful lot of work that is associated with figure quality work, sub-editing of the papers, and then finally publication, and then dissemination of this work to put it, if you like, in front of a very large audience. These processes have a cost associated with them. And of course, not every journal offers such an array of services and support, if you like. I think, so if we agree that there is a cost, I think that the question really, the really important question to ask is who needs to bear this cost? And I think in this context, what I, as an editor, actually find really interesting is this move towards what's been referred to as transformative agreements. So these are agreements with funders or institutions to effectively cover the costs of publishing from authors, from researchers who belong to these institutions or are funded by those funders. And so Springer Nature previously had a number of these agreements which did not include Nature portfolio journals, but in the autumn there was an announcement of the first such agreement with Max Planck Digital Library, which offers that route to open access for authors in German institutions. The reason why I find this solution interesting is because there's such a strong analogy between this and under the subscription model, where the vast majority of researchers have access to a journal through the library, through their institution. So that cost is removed from, if you like, from the sort of daily considerations, but it's considered to be a provision that supports the way they do research. So I think, you know, if I look into the future, what kind of future would I like to see as an editor? Of course, I want all the work that we publish to be open access and accessible to anybody. But at the same time, I think that would be, to me, the kind of almost the most optimal solution, that cost is considered to be part and parcel of combined costs of doing research. Because after all, publishing is not, in my mind certainly, is not separate from scientific enterprise. It's part of it, just as doing experiments and so on is. And of course, each of these elements of engaging in science and research has its cost.
Do you think that the subscription model did get a little bit out of hand because the sums that university libraries were paying were mounting each year and crippling, and also meant that access was restricted to universities that had big library budgets?
So I am probably not the best person to answer that question, because at the beginning of this conversation, you asked me to clarify the position of editors versus the publisher. Nevertheless, let me touch on the second part of the question. And that is one of the things that I was really, that I am really gratified that we've been able to do at Springer Nature is actually to try and circumvent this issue of only limiting access to what we publish in terms of research to those who are members of particular institutions. And the way we've circumvented this is in two ways. The first one is we are part of Research for Life, which is an organization that offers complete access to all published information in countries with very low income. Research for Life is actually surprisingly little known about, including in the countries that directly benefit from it. But through Research for Life, you essentially, if you are in one of these countries, you can get completely seamless access or completely full access to everything we publish. And the second part of it is, some years ago now, Springer Nature developed an online functionality called ShareDit, which is essentially an online functionality which allows you to read the entirety of everything we publish. These links are available to authors or subscribers at the end of every article. And in fact, these are the links that we always use in social media sharing, trying to ensure that as many readers have access to the full content as possible.
Yeah, about low and low middle income countries. If I can ask you a question for you personally, are you not afraid that this cost that is around $10,000 will introduce a kind of inequity in open access because some low and low middle income country will not be able to pay for this this cost, and so that we end up with an unbalanced published article based on the funding, actually?
So let me first of all say something that, just to clarify, the opportunities for getting published in Nature and other journals of Nature Portfolio. So we are offering an open access option. It's an option. It's entirely up to the authors who are submitting to the journals whether they continue through the, let's call it a traditional route, or whether they follow the open access route. So I just wanted to make it clear that in that sense, there is an option which remains open for everyone.
Is this a step towards the days when there won't be an option, because that will be the way that everyone publishes?
It is a step towards that goal. In the Plan S parlance, if you like, we now qualify as a transformative journal. And just to explain that very briefly, a transformative journal is a journal that offers open access option, but which at some point has the ambition of becoming completely open access. Now,
because today, sorry, I just interrupted you, but just to clarify, today, most institutions will still have to pay a subscription to Nature, because not all their readers will be authors and not all their articles. So they're paying twice in some way.
Well, so this is where transformative agreements actually resolve this issue, because it's a combined solution precisely to prevent these kinds of complications, if you like. But what I should say, to come back to the question, the speed of that transition to open access is determined by the community.
In which way?
Because you as the author have the choice of which model you submit under.
So the day that all the authors who publish in Nature choose an open access option will be the day that the subscription ceases.
I mean, if everybody wants to publish open access, then it becomes an open access journal, right? I mean, that's.
Okay. How do you respond personally to the response of the community? So there's been lots of debate. I'm sure you saw lots of Twitter feeds around these announcements. What do you think, Magdalena, to the how people have responded?
So my first most personal response as editor of Nature and a long-term editor is one of disappointment, because in the most fierce criticisms, there is no recognition of the incredible effort that the editors put into working with the community to improve the communication and dissemination of research. I would have hoped that regardless how you feel about the figure that was communicated, those efforts that I and my colleagues have engaged in and continue to engage in would have been at least acknowledged. However, I will be the first to admit that Twitter is not exactly a forum for nuanced discussion and communication.
So this goes to back to a point that we raised and discussed with you last time we spoke, which was your metaphor of the knight in shining armor, the battle of against publishing, and I sort of get the feeling, and I'm, correct me if I'm wrong, that the editor is somewhere placed between the publisher, who we understand is a business, looking for a business model, and the community. And in some ways, you are serving both. And is there a certain, were you involved in the discussions to convince the publisher, for example? Is that?
To convince them of what?
To go down there to accelerate the access, the movement towards an open access model.
So I'm not sure that this analogy of that you just painted is helpful, or maybe I just don't understand it very well. But if we talk about open access as a way of disseminating information, it's a conversation in which the whole community is engaged. Of course, researchers themselves, funders themselves, the general public, interested general public, editors, publishers. So it's a very large table with very many stakeholders at it. I think all of us agree that open access, and actually ultimately open science, which to me is the real goal, and open access is a phase that will take us in that direction. I think all of us agree that the goal is worthy, important, and we agree that it should be a goal for us all. As always, the devil is in the detail, and how do we get there? How do we enable that goal to be achieved, whether it's that, in my mind, intermediate goal, if you like, open access, or the ultimate goal of open science. So I think the discussion was very broad. It was a discussion with all these constituents. And as we were just saying a few minutes ago, that discussion has unfolded over at least a couple of decades. Mm-hmm. And so what we're seeing is a sort of acceleration of these conversations and now decisions being made to enabling this option on Nature. And Nature portfolio.
Can you explain just one last piece of this, which is, and I want you to clarify, because I'm not sure I really understood it, but I've read that there is something called guided open access pilot, which, as I understand, proposes, and I think it's a pilot, it's an experiment, of a non-refundable submission fee of over 2,000 euros to cover the peer review process. Could you comment on that?
I can. I can, to begin with, correct your statement. It is not a submission fee. It is not a submission fee, and it does not cover peer review. It covers editorial evaluation, which includes peer review and its analysis.
I thought I took these from something that was written by Nature, but I may have put in the submission fee. It may have been upon submission rather than a submission fee.
Right. So we have written quite extensively to explain the pilot. It is indeed a pilot. It's an experiment. And the experiment is designed to achieve a number of goals, actually. I personally find it a very interesting approach to publishing, and publishing robustly, but also quickly, so that redundancies in the publication system are eliminated insofar that it's possible. So let me explain. The pilot essentially involves a subset of journals. So there are three research journals, Nature Physics, Nature Genetics, and Nature Methods. And an author has an opportunity or can select to effectively submit simultaneously their manuscript for consideration of three journals. So let's say you can imagine a path along which you would have a manuscript where you say, well, I'm interested in submitting to Nature Genetics, but I could also imagine being considered by Nature Communications and Communications Biology. So it's essentially a collaborative effort amongst these editors to evaluate the manuscript. And then, should they be interested, send it for peer review, and then subsequently provide a really very extensive set of editorial comments and guidance based on editorial evaluation and peer review to say to the authors, given this work as it stands, for example, these sets of comments and further experiments would need to be carried out in order for us to consider it further in Nature Genetics. a subset of those would need to be required for further consideration in edu communications. But actually, perhaps in this theoretical example, as is, communications biology would be happy to offer an accept in principle pending some minor revisions, right? And so then the author puts a decision back with the author, who can then evaluate how critical is it that the paper is published, quote unquote, tomorrow, how much funding is available in terms of carrying out experiments, which of these experiments are feasible, etc., etc. So the author then can evaluate what the most desirable, the most practical course of action for their manuscript is. So it's a pilot. It literally started at the beginning of the year, so just very recently. We are, like anybody else, looking forward to seeing how much interest there is in this option. It's designed to eliminate multiple rounds of peer review at multiple journals. It's designed to maximize on the kind of expertise and commenting that the editors can provide. It remains to be seen whether it's useful to the community, whether the community finds it useful.
So if I understand the way you describe it, but it would have to apply to a range of journals of different...
The different editorial bar.
Different editorial bar. So you would have to have the range, but you're paying for the service to have a cross-evaluation with a feedback. Is that right?
The initial fee is associated with the evaluation, the editorial evaluation, if you like. So that guidance... hence guided away, that guidance, which of the journals is most suitable and what will be required to meet the expectations of the different journals.
And have you had some uptake?
Well, so as I mentioned, we only opened this option literally just a few days ago. And yes, we have had some submissions.
So what is the objective of the experiment? To see what people are willing to pay for, how people want to be accompanied, what's the objective?
Well, from my perspective, the objective very much is to provide the best possible service to the authors. So when I think back to the time when I was a researcher, I submitted manuscripts to journals. Back then, it was literally completely a black box. I had no idea who looked at my paper, whether they read it or not. And so the idea here is that there is great transparency of who's involved, who reads the paper, who evaluates it, and what criteria are being taken into consideration for the different journals. And then to me, what's important is that the decision point is really given to the authors, right? It's up to the authors which of these journals in this pilot they select, as I say, based on their own needs, willingness, time, funding to revise the manuscript appropriately.
You have had for several years a system by which the reviews can be passed if the decision by a journal to reject the reviews and the manuscript can be passed seamlessly from one journal to another with different bars, right?
That's correct. But the level of editorial guidance was really rather different. So we never really maximized or capitalized in any way, in a true kind of consolidated way, the type of guidance or almost, you know, it's almost a consultation from the editors that we're providing in the guided away format.
I'd like to thank you for coming back. I think you underline something which I think is very important, which is the process of producing and sharing and also archiving. We haven't really talked about storage and archiving scientific information is a complex one, and as you've said, the we're all in some ways searching for new ways to bring that into the 21st century. And that involves many stakeholders and it's a complicated process.
So that's it for this episode. Thank you for joining us at The Lonely Pipet.
We hope that you learned something new, that something resonated with your own experiences, or that you just enjoyed the science.
Let us know your thoughts on Twitter @LonelyPipet. And please, share it with your friends in the lab. If you want to join our community, you can subscribe to the Lonely Pipette mailing list or mail us by following the link available on our Twitter profile. You will receive the next episodes directly in your mailbox. How cool is that?
Stay tuned for the next show, and remember, you might feel like a lonely pipette, but it doesn't mean you're alone. Tips from the Lonely Pipette can help you to do better science.
A bientôt!
A bientôt!
Hey guys, one last thing to finish up. If you like the soundtrack of the show, you might want to know who is the artist behind it. The song is called Lovely Swindler by Amaria, a talented French artist who composes electro swing. We are really grateful for allowing us to use it, and if you like it too, the best thing to do is to share it. Thanks again, and see you soon!